yet by measuring the amplitude of the undesired tones being generated, the information is right there on the screen, and it's telling you in a very deterministic manner, traceable to the Bureau, exactly how nonlinear is your ideal gold-plated amplifier. Now, the way the test for third-order intercept and fifth-order intercept is measured is by changing the amplitude of the two tones. Usually, you're putting the two tones through something like a precision step attenuator, where you can even measure the two tones up and down together. You can move them up and down in 1 dB steps, 3 dB steps, 10 dB steps. One of the things you'll discover is that if your amplifier is behaving in a typical manner, as you change the amplitude of the two tones by 1 decibel, the absolute power of the third under-intercept points will move by 3 decibels. The absolute power of the fifth order intercept will move by 5 decibels. The absolute power of the seventh order intercept will move by 7 decibels. As you can see, the third order, when you plot amplitude horizontally versus amplitude vertically, amplitude horizontally is the amplitude of the two tones you're putting in. Vertically, you're measuring both the fundamentals and these other harmonics, these other products coming out, and you're plotting them simultaneously, vertically, so to speak, and you'll have a line going across the screen at a 45-degree angle for your fundamentals. That's a slope of 1:1. You'll have a line that has a slope of 3:1 for your third-order intercept points, and a line for your fifth-order intercept points, 5:1. Where your line, if you extend the line for the fundamentals, the 45-degree line, you extend it beyond the place where you really made the measurement, and you do the same thing with the third-order intercept points. You extend that line. Obviously, that line, those two lines hit each other somewhere, and therefore that's called the third-order intercept point. Now, there's two or three different ways you can do the Don test. First of all, you change the amplitude of the two tones going in up to the point where the amplifier goes into approximately 1 decibel of amplitude compression. A rough rule of thumb is that 1 decibel of amplitude compression, your third order intercept, your third order intermodulation products will be approximately 20 decibels down, or is it 10 decibels? I think it's 20 decibels down, an average amplifier. And you don't go beyond the point of 1 dB compression because the amplifier now starts behaving in multiple ways of
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You almost never carry the test beyond the point of 1 dB compression because now other kinds of nonlinearity take place, and you don't get these simple 3:1 and 5:1 and 1:1 slopes anymore. But when you're making this plot on the fundamental amplitude that you're plotting across the screen, are you plotting the amplitude of one line, the power of the two lines, or the peak envelope power of the two lines? You get three different lines of 45-degree slope when you do that. When it comes to the third-order intercept products, do you plot the power of one of them, both of them in a power relationship, or both of them in a voltage relationship? You're about to ask, what is the standard? And I think the standard is 1:1 going in and 1:1 coming out. In other words, you look at the amplitude of one of the two tones going in, that's the 45-degree line, and you compare it against one of the third-order intercept lines coming back out, and that's the 3:1 slope. You can do it that way. When it comes to at what power level are you putting in, you've got multiple ways of reading that. You can talk about the amplitude of each of the two lines, the two input carriers. You can talk about the average power of the two carriers, or you can talk about the peak envelope power of two carriers. When you use peak envelope power of the two carriers, which is a 6 decibel increase over any one of them, the data you get back out looks more desirable. It gives you a better sounding specification when it comes to an equipment rating report, and therefore that's the way they often do it. You'll notice that the ARRL tests are done that way, and the industry, when it comes to single sideband transmitters, usually do it that way. Let me drop. So they measure the power of one single signal, even though there's two of them there. They call that power 6 dB above what it really is. If I was putting in a minus 10 dBm pair of tones, each one minus 10 dBm, the peak and below power of them would be minus 4 dBm, 6 dB higher than any one, and they would say that that would be on the horizontal axis, that would be the minus 4 dBm power input for that particular plot that you're generating, and now you measure the amplitude of the third order intercept, one of those products coming back out. Do you measure both of them together as a power relationship or a voltage relationship? You get 0, 3, and 6 dB difference, as you can tell. I think they used the peak envelope power of the two tones going in compared to one single tone coming back out. What is the power? They make that 3-to-1 plot and look at where the lines cross, and they call it the third order intercept point. And you can do the same thing for the fifth order intercept point. And third order and fifth order intercept points sometimes come out close to each other. As you can tell, there's multiple ways of defining the test, and in some cases, you might have to ask your particular vendor of your particular amplifier how he did it to make sure you are both on the same page. I've run into that problem from time to time. I'd like to believe there's a standard. I'm not positive that everyone agrees to a standard on this one, John. W82VDH, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Then K2KEY.
Okay. In fact, let's pick up Mel first. K2KEY, tell me what you believe is the standard as to how it's done, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, how do they do it? How do they define two-tone, first of all, two-tone dynamic range? Actually, they do define it as a point where the two-tone dynamic range, for instance, on a receiver. Let's look at a receiver, how it's received, or how it's looked at on a spectrum analyzer, because what is a spectrum analyzer? It actually is a receiver. So they look at it at approximately a 20 kilohertz point on the bandpass. Now, at that point, they look at the IMD above the point where, like you say, it increases at the rate of 3-to-1 with the parent signal. In other words, expressing it another way, that the level, the parent signal, the IMD increases at the rate of 3 times faster than the parent signal. This is the basic measurement as it is concerned. What you're talking about is the crossing points, like the what they call the 3 dB compression points. Dick, over.
Yes and no. First of all, when it comes to real peak amplitude compression, rarely does it go beyond 1 decibel of instantaneous compression when the two signals are co-phased during that instant. But where those two lines come together, it's called the third order intercept point. Those two lines, the 3-to-1 slope line and the 1-to-1 slope line, hit each other. But now we've had quite a few questions that guys are asking, what in the world do all these readings mean when it comes to dynamic range of a receiver? When it comes to instantaneous dynamic range, blocking dynamic range, quite often what they'll do is first measure what is the sensitivity of the receiver when a signal is right on channel. Then they'll take a second signal generator, tuned off to one side, 20 kilohertz or some number like that, start cranking up the second signal generator, and maybe the second signal generator is generating two tones, such that the intercept, the third order intermodulation product, might fall into the passband that the receiver is now tuned to. And when that third order product starts coming above threshold, that amplitude of what goes in versus the sensitivity, that's one way of reading receiver dot and dynamic range. Another way you can do it is to have a weak signal continuously in the center of the channel, and you're taking a single tone 20 kilohertz away and cranking it up until the signal on channel changes by some determinable amount, like 1 dB of change in its amplitude. That's called a blocking dynamic range. Good receivers have numbers like 80 and 90 decibels of dynamic range and blocking dynamic range. And I bet you've seen a number of these tests. And by the way, you guys will have a beautiful, there's a beautiful set of data on many of the popular transceivers that we all know and love. If you go to a website that is www.com, Delta Foxtrot 9 India Charlie dot Delta Echo. So in other words, this German amateur, DF9IC, whiskey dot Delta Foxtrot 9 India Charlie dot Delta Echo. That means Germany. You go to that particular web page, and about 10 lines down, you'll see something called Test Results of 144 Megahertz All Mode Transceivers. And these guys, when you go to that particular indication on their main website, you'll open up with a great big page full of data. At the bottom of that page full of data, you'll see some really beautiful photographs of this guy in an extremely well-equipped laboratory with very good test equipment, and you see how they made these measurements. And the measurements they're making, because they're using state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line test equipment, the measurements they made for dynamic range of many of the radios we all own, let me drop, turned out to be 5 and 10 decibels better than the published reports that were done by the many of the magazines that you and I can read. It turns out that when you're trying to create an extremely good signal generator in order to do the dynamic range test of a receiver, you better make sure that the frequency synthesizer built into your signal generator has extreme spectral purity. In other words, that synthesizer better be putting out one and only one tone, and there better be no residual phase or frequency modulation of that tone. A good signal generator that does that, in some cases you have to spend some money. In some cases, just buy on the surplus market, I think it's called 8640 Charlie by Hewlett Packard. It's a signal generator that goes up to something like 1200 megacycles and down to a couple of megacycles, or down to 450 kilohertz. And that it is known to have an extremely good frequency synthesizer built in. So you start off with the right piece of test equipment, as these guys did on this particular website, and you look at the measurements they got, and you realize that the measurements they got are quite a bit better than the published results you've been reading about in other journals up till now. So there are ways of testing receivers that are really something else, and I wonder if you had a chance to see that website. I think I mailed an email to you on that subject earlier today, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That's Roger. This is K2KEY. All right, wait. Well, let's just stay at one point for a minute, Dick, about IMD. If you look at the plot, and they begin, let's say, at the receiver's noise floor, would you agree that they extend on a one-to-one ratio to a point? First, let's get that, you know, I'm not sure that we're both on the same track with this, Dick, over.
Yeah, when it comes to testing receiver, you've got multiple ways of finding out what is its weakest signal sensitivity. There's something called MDS, minimum discernible signal. You can also have 3 decibels of signal plus noise to noise ratio. So how you define the sensitivity of the receiver, the weakest signal it can receive for a particular resolution bandwidth. I mean, you're going to get a different number when you use the 500 kilohertz filter versus using the 2.5 kilohertz filter. And you're going to get a different answer. But how you define the sensitivity of the receiver, you got to make sure that you and the guy who wrote the data sheet are again, agreeing with your terms. I think that's what you're getting at, Mel. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. This is K2KEY. All right. If we look at this ratio, the one-to-one ratio, to the point, let's say, 2-3 dB compression point, I believe that's what they referred to it, when it extends upwards to the 3 dB compression point of both signals, and that is where the IMD intersects. So we call that the intermod intercept point, correct?
I'm not so sure I agree on this one now, Mel. First of all, when it comes to compression, various ways of testing dynamic range where compression of the receiver might take place, to my knowledge, they rarely go beyond 1 decibel of compression. In other words, I might be putting a weak signal right on the center of channel where the receiver is tuned, and I want to measure what is the blocking dynamic range, and 20 kilohertz away, I'll start cranking up a very strong second signal that I'm putting into the receiver simultaneous with that weak signal, and I crank up that second signal until it gets so strong that something in the receiver starts going into limiting, and now the weak signal that's on channel gets suppressed by 1 decibel, maybe 3, but I think 1 decibel is a more typical test for blocking dynamic range. But here I'm not absolutely sure, Redmill. Back to you, K2RIW.
When I read the specifications of, what Roden Schwartz was supplying the ARRL and how they were going to go about evaluating receiver performance, I particularly was interested because I have done some of these experiments, especially like you mentioned, the signal generators, the Hewlett-Packard generators. I did have quite a bit of use of those generators, the 86 series, I had plenty of fun with those fancy generators. We used them extensively. Now, the point is that I was paying attention to what the ARRL was going to do when they got that equipment, because Roden Schwartz, supplied it, and Rode DL4, it was DL4UR at the time, Dr. Rode, and the way he explained it was using the plot starting at the receiver's noise floor, which was attenuated. In other words, have two plots. The second plot, let me let it drop. All right, the second plot was attenuated by 20 dB, so that the plot beginning at the receiver's noise floor would extend at a constant ratio of 1:1 up to the point where he called it the 3 dB compression point for both signals and at the IMD intercept. And he called that the intermod intercept point, Dick. I remember that very distinctly, over.
Okay, I'm going to agree with you on that. I think I am. By the way, the 8640 series of signal generators, what makes them so quiet and so good is it's not a pure frequency synthesizer in the normal manner. When you use a ordinary divide circuit, a programmable divide circuit in a phase lock loop, what you're really measuring is the instantaneous frequency. You're comparing it after counting it down to a standard. And so there are groups of time, there are blocks of time in which the receiver, the voltage-controlled oscillator, is free-running, and it makes other products. That 8640 signal generator doesn't do that. It has a cavity oscillator, extremely quiet cavity oscillator, being mixed with one other signal with some very good filters afterwards. And then it has something inside called a freak lock loop, not a phase lock loop, and it manages to make an extremely quiet signal. So frequency synthesizers, the good news is that you can ask for an extremely precise frequency out of them. The bad news is they all have other funny products that when you're doing this kind of a receiver test, it can make life pretty miserable. So you're fairly sure 3 decibels of compression was the recommended procedure by Mr. Elric Rohde, and I just looked up those call letters. That's not his current call letters, Mel. Back to you, K2RIW.
He now has American call letters. He's got a KB2 call letter now. Forgot what it was. Gee, I worked with him a couple of times. We used to get together on 75 meters because he used to work out, and he was out in Jersey at the time working for RCA Worldwide Communications, and a friend of mine also was an engineer there. Got to talking about ham radio, and bingo, he hooked us up together. And we had a lot of, I have tremendous amounts of information that he sent me on his work that he did and how to, in fact, that was the genesis of me building that homebrew receiver that that was my nightmare, but worked out phenomenally well. Yeah, it definitely was that the 3 dB of compression, I know of both signals. I remember that. I remember how he laid out the dynamic range of approximately 99 dB. A dynamic range and a noise floor at minus 134 dBm and Oh, I don't remember. I remember, but I remember, you know, little factors here and there, Dick, of how he presented it. And it was quite interesting to understand, you know, exactly how the genesis of it was when it came to so-called two-tone dynamic range testing. Over.
By the way, right now, Elric Rohde, R-O-H-D-E, Elric L. Rohde, has a, he's got multiple calls. One of his calls is November 1 Uniform Lima, November 1 Uniform Lima, and that has an address in Marco Island, Florida. And quite a few of his family members are also ham radio operators, and the last time I looked, I found out he had about three or four different sets of call letters. Oh, here's another one. Delta Juliet 2 Lima Romeo. Also Victor Papa 8 Charlie Romeo Lima. And Hotel Bravo 9 Alpha Whiskey Echo. My goodness, he's all over the place. DL 1 Romeo. Delta Lima 1 Romeo. All of these are Elric L. Rohde. Licensed in various places. He's got lots of ham licenses. So, which of all of the measurements constitutes the majority of the mail you get, Mel, saying, gee, I wish I understood these measurements of transceivers? Is it blocking dynamic range? Is it two-tone dynamic range? Which of the measurements do you believe you get the most amount of mail? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, most of it, as you say, started out with MDS. What is MDS? And then SINED, signal-to-noise ratio, SB to calibration. What the heck does it mean? Like you get a signal that 0.25, say, microvolt into a 50-ohm input. What exactly does that mean? Well, what is it actually, how do they determine, you know, a receiver SB to calibration, say, 50 microvolt for F9? Those are the questions. For instance, understanding that a readable single sideband signal requires a 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio above the noise floor. What the heck do they mean by that 10 dB? And for example, and also showing that a lot of... And I have to explain also, for example, modern receivers with noise floors of approximately minus 130 dBm will produce a readable single sideband signal at, say, minus 120 dBm. You know, explaining that, this is the main factors that you just look at, and then a lot of the other stuff is a lot of hype picked over.
You talk to a guy who's serious about moonbounds, and you ask him what is a minimum discernible signal. Because they're an extremely different answer than if you ask a hi-fi enthusiast. When it comes to single sideband signals, I was living with approximately 1.5 to 2 dB of apparent signal-to-noise ratio. In other words, the S meter on my receiver was moving about 1.5 to 2 decibels, and I was getting 90% copy of a man whose vocabulary I knew because I was running a series of single sideband, long-range tropo experiments with K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles away on 432 megacycles. I'm using this great big array of 16 Yagis on 100 feet of power and a kilowatt of power going into it. And he was using four very good Yagis on 100 feet of power down there in Greensboro, 200 miles inland. Of that 480-mile path, big portions of it were over land. Very little of it was over water. We were so excited about the fact that 480 miles, summer, winter, spring, and fall, could be bridged on 432 megacycle sideband. We were so happy about that that we ran a sked every Tuesday night. Let me drop. We ran a sked every Tuesday night for 4.5 years because we didn't believe it. And lots of people on both ends were listening, and because some of those guys were using less equipment, they weren't hearing the other side, and they said, these guys are just running a phony QSO. They're really on the telephone. Well, all of a sudden, there were some guys in between hearing the signals from both directions saying, no, these guys are really doing it. They're just using better equipment than you're using. So we were listening to a couple of decibels of what appeared to be signal-to-noise ratio. But 50 microvolts on an S meter, meaning S9, that's something as a gentleman's agreement. Zillions of years ago, everybody agreed to that, and every other S unit below that is half the voltage. 50 microvolts is S9. 25 microvolts is S8. 12.5 microvolts is S7, and so on, all the way down. That's an agreed-upon standard. That's the good news. The bad news is probably nobody but Collins receivers comes close to meeting that standard. You actually take a good signal generator with a good step attenuator on the front end, and you step it down in 6 decibel steps, and you expect it, starting off at 50 microvolts out of your signal generator, you expect it to go down 1 S unit every time you go down by 6 dB. It doesn't do that. Many of the receivers at first move 5 dB per step, and then 3 dB per step, and then 2 dB per step. And so, in other words, quite a few of them are very far away from 50 microvolts for S9. Very, very many of them are very generous on the S meter readings. Everybody is S9 and 10 and 20 dB above it on the S meter that's on the average receiver. The average receiver manufacturer has recognized the fact that if they had a Scotch sounding S meter and the guy was giving honest reports off of that S meter, an awful lot of people would not want to talk to him anymore. He wouldn't be very popular. So to make sure that your brand of receiver is well accepted, you make sure that the S meter reads very liberally, reads very high. You'll discover that the majority of receivers do that. And so you have to run your own calibration chart, and if you're willing to really do a lot of fancy curve tracing circuitry, you can make an adapter circuit into the AGC network of your receiver, and you can force that S meter to be a lot more accurate. Probably generating your own calibration chart is an easier way to go. So everyone knows what the standard is for an S meter. 98% of all the receivers you can buy don't come even close. I bet you've run a few of those tests, and I bet you said to yourself, Mel, gee, am I doing something wrong? Could it really be that bad? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Oh, boy. You'll be amazed how they exaggerate, just like they exaggerate antenna gains years ago, and that's why the ARRL, you know, does not publish anything like that anymore. But one other thing while we're on receivers, one other question that I've gotten. There have been some that reviews of receivers, and they come up with another term called, and people just don't understand this, what is reciprocal mixing? What the heck is reciprocal mixing, and how does this affect the receiver? So if you want to say a few words about reciprocal mixing, we'll see if we can clear that up. I was going to bring up all these things, you know, weeks ago. You remember we started talking about receivers. And it was getting down the line, and this is one of the, actually, reciprocal mixing is a part of noise level. So would you like to start, Dick? I think you can lead in better than I can. Over.
Okay, every super heterodyne receiver has an RF front end with some amplification, hopefully some filtering, going into a mixer that mixes it down to the first IF. Rough rule of thumb, good receiver design for a super heterodyne receiver. Each IF stage is approximately 10% of the frequency of the previous RF stage. So if I was building a receiver for 144 megacycles, I might build a first IF of 14 megacycles. That happens not to be the number to use, but you could. And then if I had a second conversion, I might convert from 14 megacycles down to 1.4 megacycles. If I had a third conversion, I might convert from 1.4 down to 140 kilohertz. That would be a good receiver, good design practices. The reason why you use an IF frequency lower than the RF frequency is because a same amount of kilohertz of bandwidth of filtering becomes easier and easier when you do it at lower frequencies. If I wanted a receiver, a good single sideband receiver at 2 meters that has a 2.4 kilohertz bandwidth single sideband filter, and if I tried to do it directly at 144 megacycles. Let me drop. It's not impossible, but extremely difficult. That filter would have to have an unloaded queue of 50,000 to do that. And that filter would, it would be a great big cavity filter. It would be an ugly piece of hardware. By way of the superheterodyne process, you beat it down to lower and lower frequencies. A simple little crystal filter or a simple integrated circuit with an operational amplifier can give you a beautiful filter once you beat it down to lower frequencies. That's the main advantage of superheterodyne. That's the good news. The bad news is every one of those mixing stages has an image and a reel. That's one of the kinds of reciprocal mixing. In other words, in order to beat 144 megacycles down to 14 megacycles, I may be beating it with a carrier that is at 130 megacycles. The local oscillator is at 130 megacycles. I beat 144 with it, and it comes out with a difference of 14 megacycles for the first IF. That's the good news. The bad news is that on one side of that local oscillator is the desired signal, 14 megacycles away. On the other side of the oscillator, 28 megacycles away, twice 14, is another reception. That's called the image reception. The mixer itself, the mixer has no smarts to know the difference between the high side mixing and the low side mixing, what you call image and reel mixing. Let me drop. Unless you build yourself an extremely elaborate circuit that's called an image phasing mixer, which uses the techniques very similar to the so-called phasing type single sideband generator, which a few people used way back in the dark ages of the late 50s and early 60s. Image phasing mixer is the one kind of mixer which can tell the difference between the high side and low side mixing. Most real mixers cannot. The doubly balanced mixer you buy from many circuits doesn't know the difference. Works equally well on each. So therefore, you've got to have extremely good filtering to make sure that only the desired frequency is applied to the mixer and the image frequency is suppressed by a whole lot of dB. So one of the measurements that a good product report will tell you is about is what is the image response. It'd like the image response to be 90 decibels weaker than the real response on your particular receiver. And you can come up with a rating for that on each one of the bands you use it on. High end of the band, middle of the band, low end of the band, each one of the bands, 80, 60, 40, 20, 17, 15, and so on meters. You make these measurements, image and real response. You take, for instance, the Heathkit AR3 receiver, the first receiver I ever owned way back in the dark ages of 1956, when you were on the 10-meter band at around 28 megacycles, the image coming into that receiver was about 2 decibels weaker than the real. So you really were tuning 2 spots on the dial simultaneously, roughly 900 KC apart, 455 KC IF. And so whatever the IF frequency is, you double that, and that many megacycles away from your real response is an image response. That's one of the kinds of so-called undesired mixing products. I think there's another one you're referring to here, Mel. Let me pass it back to you. K2KEY, K2RIW.
What about up conversions? Okay, we've got everything. Let's take it step by step. Let's stay with what we have. Yes, reciprocal, known as reciprocal mixing. One of the problems that we have faced when they came along with the more modern equipment in the last years, we have gone to things such as what is known as VCOs, voltage-controlled oscillators, phase-locked loops, and they do generate sidebands that enter the mixer and combine and then enter into the IF strip. And it's called reciprocal mixing. Now, the situation, like Dick just said, is many times the mixer can't really handle it. And I have run into this problem. In fact, I have rebuilt a number of receivers, especially my mobile rig, and I found a local oscillator becomes the, how do I explain it? The specific point of the bandwidth of the local oscillator becomes a very important specification. And the problem basically is, let me drop. Basically, it's the design of the mixer. So what happens is that, unfortunately, you have to go to a better mixer, which I did. I had to buy a mixer which, compared to the original mixer that was in the radio, was quite pricey. So basically, reciprocal mixing, I'll make it simple, is the result of strong signals joining with the local oscillator to produce sidebands. I mean, that's as simple as I can think of saying what is reciprocal mixing, Dick, over.
Yeah, it melds into a beautiful area here. When you study the instantaneous dynamic range of each stage of your receiver, assume your receiver now is represented on a nice page as a functional block diagram. You got the antenna input port, you got the first RF tuning filter, the first RF amplifier, a filter after that. That goes into a mixer, mixing down to the first IF frequency. There's the first IF frequency filter, the IF frequency amplifier, another filter after that maybe, and maybe another stage of mixing if it's a dual conversion receiver, and so on. When you represent that as a functional block diagram, you'll discover that the RF amplifier has got some pretty good dynamic range, and if you've done a good job of filtering, he's only letting through the desirable signals. The mixer is supposed to mix all of those signals coming in that pass through the RF amplifier and the RF amplifier's filters. It's only supposed to be operating on those and mixing them down to the IF frequency. However, there's a rough rule of thumb of almost every mixer that has ever been built, with a couple of exceptions, and that is the mixer is fairly linear. Linear meaning that 1 dB of change of the RF input is going to be 1 dB of change of the IF output amplitude. And the frequency going in and the frequency going out is related one-to-one by the local oscillator that it's being mixed with. That's pretty good up to a point. As the signal gets stronger and stronger, all of a sudden the mixer is no longer linear. Rough rule of thumb for most mixers is that the RF amplitude going into the mixer should never exceed 10 dB below the local oscillator power. If my local oscillator is running at 0 dBm of local oscillator power going in, I better not put in a stronger RF signal than 10 dB below that. If there isn't a 10 dB difference or more between the RF amplitude going into a mixer and the local oscillator power, there's a strong possibility that your mixer is starting to behave non-linearly, and it will create third-order intermod and other products. Every phase-lock loop system that's making your local oscillator must have other residual products connected to it. It's got the artifacts, as they're sometimes called. If the final reference frequency of your phase-lock loop, let me drop, is 10 kilohertz, for instance, there are going to be sidebands on that local oscillator, 10 kilohertz above and below, 20 kilohertz above and below, 30 kilohertz above and below. Every phase-lock loop oscillator has all of these other products alongside of that local oscillator if you look at it on a good spectrum analyzer. You can't say that they're gone. You can discuss how many decibels they're suppressed, depending on how good your design is, but they're always there. Every phase-lock loop has got harmonics, intermods, mixings of the reference oscillator frequency, all kinds of other products that are in there. When you start getting stronger and stronger RF signals going into that mixer, and that mixer is being fed a local oscillator that has these impurities, it will find some way of letting your strong local signal from your broadcast station 10 miles away, a television signal, is going to start mixing by some means in that mixer, coming out of your IF strip, and eventually it's going to come out of the loudspeaker, and you're going to be unhappy about it. So the purity, the spectral purity in instantaneous phase deviations, the spectral purity in all other undesired artifacts and undesired products that are in that local oscillator is extremely important. So if you're building a state-of-the-art receiver, you're going to give it a tremendous amount of local oscillator power. You're going to make sure that the local oscillator is the purest thing you've ever seen. You're going to make sure that the RF energy going into that from the RF amplifier is on extremely well filtered. Nothing else could get in there. And you're going to make sure it doesn't exceed these amplitude requirements. The bottom line is that most receivers, the weakest link of the chain, the thing that gives you the most amount of undesired nonlinearities, quite often is the first mixing stage. And therefore, they do all kinds of fancy things like putting in roofing filters and fancy filters and high dynamic range techniques and image phasing mix.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Product detectors and whatever. You've got to put a lot of smart into the mixer if you're building a really good receiver. When you make any of these measurements and product reports, any of the transceivers that we can get our hands on, I'll bet you, in most cases, of all of the things that are not so desirable about your particular transceiver, a high percentage of them are starting at that first mixer. A lot of good engineering is required right there if you want the rest of the receiver to behave. And for the average guy, that's about 3 transistors downrange from the antenna port. Everyone thinks the first RF amplifier is the first thing that goes into nonlinearity. Very rarely. It's 3, 4, or 5 stages downrange. Mixer or first IF amplifier is where an awful lot of the grief quite often takes place. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Call me a V2HWW with some comments here, please.
Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Exactly. Dick, you said it very well. You know, and that's really where the crux of the problem is. We sometimes refer to it as phase noise or reciprocal mixing problems, but you hit the nail right on the head when you said about the mixes. And I ran into that, and there is a couple of mixes, one in particular that I found to be excellent. And it is not used usually in the radios other than the very high-end radios. I mean, you can imagine that it separates, as they say, the men from the boys for a number of dollars. That really is an outrageous amount considering the overall price of the piece of equipment. But go ahead, and then, oh yes, I want to make comments on that. I get a lot of email on that. Last week, the gentleman just before me brought up about the experiment on the Smith chart, and a lot of people did duplicate that experiment and said that they had a lot of success with it. In fact, they found that doing it that method with adding the 25 ohm resistor in and then comparing the measurements and the plot against a off-the-shelf so-called noise bridge, it's extremely favorable, Dick. Over.
Glad to hear that. And I'm going to have to go back to that and get into a little bit more of the details, because I had some trouble. I would come up with the right ballpark figure, but there was enough error in the answer that I was a little unhappy with it. And I was doing it mathematically. And when you've got a good mathematical process, there shouldn't be any error. Yes, the way you draw the lines on a Smith chart by using a broad pencil or a narrow pencil and doing it carefully, that can make a difference. But I was seeing an error beyond that I couldn't quite identify, but maybe I wasn't doing it right. Now, Howie did mention one other thing before called up-converting. If you're building the very first stage of a spectrum analyzer, good spectrum analyzers nowadays, the first band covers 0 to 2 gigahertz, the next band covers 2 to 4, and then 4 to 8, and 8 to 12, and numbers like that. The first band covering essentially 0 to 2 gigahertz, if you think about it, it's really an infinite number of octaves. Let me drop. And so if you're trying to build a filter for the RF front end, and you're going to go from 0 to 2 gigahertz, and you want the filter to track and give you no image response into that mixer, it's essentially a design that's impossible. So what many of these scanner receivers and many of the spectrum analyzers do is they take the first band of 0 to 2 gigahertz, up-convert it to an IF of something like 2.3 gigahertz, carefully filter that, and then beat it back down again. At first it seems crazy. Why in the world did you beat it up? Well, why did you move it to a higher frequency? It's the opposite of the normal superheterodyne process. You pick up some really good advantages when you do it right. There's no local oscillator squirting out the front end. You've got a 0 to 2 gigahertz, very carefully designed bandpass filter. And because you're up-converting to a higher frequency with the local oscillator always on the high side, 2.3 gigs to 4.3 gigs is where the local oscillator is, the image response from that first IF of around 2 gigs is 4.6 gigahertz away. Very easy to filter. So there is no image response. In the case of a spectrum analyzer, on the very first band, operating roughly 0 to 2 gigs, your biggest problem is to make sure that all the desired signals coming in that antenna from your local broadcast and everything else, you want them to appear on that spectrum analyzer screen just once. If you have an image and real response, even if you have 50 dB of difference between the two, every signal is going to appear on the screen somewhere twice and create a hell of a lot of confusion. So up-converting is used on some receivers. I think the ICOM RC7000 does that on some of its lower bands. I know that a high percentage of the spectrum analyzers do up-converting as the very first stage.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I said, it looks backwards at first, but there's a huge advantage from doing that. But when it comes to mixer design, Mel and I have just now discussed the degree of difficulty of making a really good mixer. You have to admit to yourself that in most receivers, the first mixer is where a hell of a lot of the grief starts out. And any grief that's created in that first mixer just trundles downrange to all the other stages of the IF and second and third conversion and detection and whatever. And it's going to, you can't subtract it downrange once you've started it in that first mixer. So that first mixer has to be extremely well designed on its dynamic range, its local oscillator amplitude, its local oscillator purity. And there's another big function you've got to worry about. And that is, when you look at the mixer specifications for a good local double balance, a good high brand name double balance mixer, that manufacturer put that into a piece of test equipment where all three ports saw 50 ohms resistors DC to light. When you put the mixer into a pure 50 ohm environment on the RF port, the LO port, and the IF port, you get some very nice performance out of a well-constructed, doubly balanced mixer. Let me drop. But now let's get real. You take that mixer where the manufacturer has told you that the third order intermods are this number of dB suppressed, and the second harmonic is this number of dB suppressed, and whatever. It gives you all these beautiful specs. You put that mixer into your real receiver. The IF port looks into a bandpass filter. The local oscillator port looks into your particular phase lock loop oscillator. The RF port looks into the RF amplifier or its filter. And each of these filters have a moderately well-defined impedance at each of their center frequencies. But out of band, each one of those filters is a dead short circuit. So awful lot of the frequencies that the local, that the doubly balanced mixer is working on, awful lot of those frequencies, the RF port is representing a short circuit, the IF port is representing a short circuit, and the local oscillator is only a moderately good impedance at its design frequency, and all other frequencies, it's a short circuit. Once you study what happens to a doubly balanced mixer, when some of the harmonics and energies that it's generating are looking into those filters that at those frequencies are a short circuit, reflecting it back into the mixer, and you think the mixer is a passive component, it's active as all hell. Any energy you reflect back into it, harmonic energy from the local oscillator, harmonic energy from a strong signal from the RF, and so on, any energy you reflect back into the mixer, he's going to find some way of combining it and giving you a product that you don't like. That's physics. If you want to get around this problem, let me drop. A smart guy will make sure he's got enough RF amplification and enough low noise amplification in the first IF strip, three stages downrange. He's worrying about having a low noise amplifier. And why is he doing that? Because he's putting pads resistive attenuator, 50 ohm resistive attenuators on the RF port and the IF port and maybe the LO port. Because he realizes that if the mixer does not see something extremely close to 50 ohms resistive on all three ports, he's not going to get anywhere near the performance that that mixer manufacturer guaranteed to him. You'd be amazed how many people forget about that. You do, and you're going to get all kinds of products out of that mixer that are going to drive you up a wall. And you're going to say, how in the world did it do that? The manufacturer said it's not supposed to do that. Turns out you're using it in a way very different than the way he rated it. Howie, you wanted to say something about this. Go ahead, Howie, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, just wanted to make a couple of comments. One, when you design a receiver, there's a lot of trade-offs. First, how much power do you want to come out of your local oscillator? Too much power, you don't want, you know, that 10 dB rule is important. But, you know, in solid-state equipment, you don't want to have too much power in the oscillator because that's going to take away power from your batteries. Or you don't want to radiate. Like in the old days, they wouldn't let you take a radio on board an aircraft because the local oscillator interfered with the instrumentation of the aircraft. Number two, a lot of receivers do not use a front end, RF front end. Some of your commercial equipment that was designed in the mid-70s and the 80s just used a mixer, hot carrier mixer, and no RF amplifier. But at the end of the day, putting this reset, when you're designing the local oscillator, you know, you have trade-offs. How much power do you want to draw? And you have to look at the linearity. You know, at the first stage, you know, the more range you want, more dynamic range you want, the higher power you have to run at that particular stage at. So when you get to your mobile equipment that runs on batteries, you're trying to save power, and that's not always what you need to do. Go ahead, Dick.
We got a comment on that.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it over to Mel next, and I've run into what Howie's describing head on. Your well-designed desktop receiver. Right now I'm looking at an old-fashioned goodie called a Kenwood TS711A. It's got a brick wall front end, so to speak. It's got very easy, very hard to overload front end. This thing has got a high dynamic range mixer, extremely good phase lock loop, and a lot of local oscillator power. That's the good news. When this thing is in the receiving mode, it's probably drawing 30 watts or something like that. And so as a desktop transceiver, it works very nicely. You take a well-designed Motorola handy-talkie running on batteries. You don't have the ability to put that much LO power in there. You're running it off a battery, you don't want the battery to be drained. So what did the guys do on Space Shuttle number 6 with Owen Gary at W5LFL? They took what they thought was the top-of-the-line Motorola handy-talkie, designed a very good antenna that could be taped to the window of the Space Shuttle. Stand by for a minute. And as he flew over the center of the United States, a little bit north of Texas, he's 1,000-some-odd miles, maybe 1,500 miles away from me. And I'm shouting at him with 1,000 watts into a 5-element or 11-element Yagi on top of a tower to try to get through to him to get above the rabble. And I listened to that tape recording. And yes, in theory, he heard K2RAW, and I got a QSL card out of it. But when you listen to that tape recording of what he heard, because he's looking at a 3,000-mile diameter of humanity simultaneously, because he's 140 nautical miles above the center of the United States, and every self-respecting ham at that time, and this is 1985, I think it was, they're all shouting him at the same time. That receiver was being overloaded by an amount you wouldn't believe. Let me drop. You had all of those broadcast transmitters, all of those radars, all of those hams, all of that RF energy going into that transceiver simultaneously. And when I listened to that tape recorder, I recognized the sound of a heavily overloaded mixer that was going crazy. A zillion of those signals that he was listening to were not starting from ham radio operators, even though that had a carefully tuned front end that was supposed to pass nothing but ham radio operators. So Howie's right on that one. In order to make a high enough dynamic range receiver, you must dissipate power in the amplifier stages, the local oscillator stages, the mixer stages. intercept point comes from running a stage at a high enough bias level. That means power. There's very little exception to that rule. You make a receiver that's very miserly on battery power, and you're running all of those stages as low a current as you can. They're going to saturate 20, 30, 40 dB sooner, and they're going to be all kinds of nonlinearities when there are strong signals in the environment. It's a trade-off. You can't have it both ways. You're either going to pay with battery drain, or you're going to pay with intermod performance of your transceiver, undesired intermod performance. It takes watts in order to get dynamic range. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right. You mentioned RF amplifiers. All right, let's talk back. I'll tell you a very interesting thing about RF amplifiers. During World War II, you could not make a receiver that did not contain an RF amplifier. And the reason for that was is because without the RF amplifier, there was a chance that the oscillator would go back up the antenna and give away your position. So all military equipment, I believe even up to now, has the RF amplifier to prevent this. After World War II and the coming of television, this problem again reared its head that the FCC insisted that all television manufacturers provide that RF amplifier. And also that basically that was one of the reasons that, you know, 300 ohm twin lead cable came into vogue, because it prevented that problem. Sometimes what was happening, you could see herringbones on certain television combination channel systems, because sometimes one side of the 300 ohm wire and the back of the TV was disconnected because of some, maybe they figured they got a better picture or something, you know, with the snow and the ghosts. So RF amplifiers did serve a very important, and still to some extent, but let me let it drop. But it does present that problem. In fact, I ran into that situation with a receiver. The first mixer, local oscillator, was being delivered a 42 megahertz signal from the local oscillator. And the mixer was receiving this plus the RF input, and it was creating a peculiar image. Even though that by the second mixer that they were already beating it down, it passed right through and formed an image that took a very high-end piece of equipment and made it, you know, basically not what you would think you paid for. So these are all situations that you've got to take into consideration. The elimination of the RF amplifier could cause your other grief, Dick, over.
WB2HWW, Dick, your Motorola radio systems are like your Voltrax and your Micors on UHF do not use an RF amplifier.
There are ways of nulling out the local oscillator that would have been re-radiated from the antenna if there isn't an RF amplifier, but it requires some smarts to do it, some extra care to do it. The FCC has on many pieces of consumer products a specification as to how strong the re-radiated local oscillator out the antenna port is allowed to be. I can remember on many occasions when I used to do television repair, quite often a person lived in a strong signal area. He had one antenna on the roof, and it came down, and the twin lead ran to two separate television sets in two separate rooms of the house. And there were certain combinations that didn't work. If one set was on channel 11 or 13, and the other set was on channel 7, the separation between the two was close to the IF frequency of the television sets, and you got herringbones and other crazy responses. Certain combinations didn't work unless you put some kind of an isolating device that divided that signal coming down from the antenna before sending it to the two television sets. Let me drop. Along comes the year 2002, so to speak, where all of a sudden a whole lot of handheld products are being created to do the reading of RFID tags, radio frequency identification tags. The majority of those receivers operating in the 915 megacycle band are a so-called zero IF system. The antenna goes straight into the very first mixer. The very first mixer beats the signal down at the RF frequency all the way down to the baseband of modulation. If the tag is giving you a amplitude modulation of a 60 kilohertz, then you're getting a 60 kilohertz signal in that first IF of that handheld receiver. So-called zero IF system. They got certain advantages. Very simple circuitry, can give you a lot of performance when it's done correctly.